So if you want to just like sit on a beach somewhere and have $20,000 magically appear in your book account every single month without risking your principal, you don't need a clever side hustle.
Right, definitely not a side hustle.
You don't need some secret life hack. You actually need roughly $8 million in cold hard cash.
Which is just a massive reality check.
It really is. Today, we're doing a deep dive into the ruthless, like, totally unyielding mathematical equation of passive wealth.
Yeah, because we're looking at this practical investment guide today that basically strips away all that daydreaming about financial freedom.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And it replaces it with the actual, literal mechanics of capital allocation. Because hitting exactly $20,000 a month, which, just to be clear, is generating $240,000 a year in pure passive income, that's a fascinating stress test for any portfolio.
Okay, let's unpack this because for most of you listening, that specific number probably sounds like the ultimate finish line,
Right,
right?
for sure. It's the dream.
But what struck me immediately about our source material today, which includes this deep dive into the underlying math, the actual asset vehicles you need, and how platforms like Osol Gamma manage all the operational friction, is that it doesn't treat this goal like a motivational seminar.
No, not at all. It's not about manifesting wealth.
Exactly. It treats it like a cold thermodynamic equation, like input equals output.
Precisely. The source forces us to look at the relationship between three very rigid constraints. You've got your available capital, your expected rate of return, and your capacity to absorb drawdowns.
The risk tolerance, basically.
Right. And if you alter one variable, the other two must inherently shift. There is no magic bullet here. And just understanding the sheer scale of the capital required, well, that's really the only way to begin approaching a mandate like this.
Right, because we can't even begin to talk about like asset allocation or tax strategies until we establish the baseline requirements. And the text lays out some incredibly stark numbers.
It really breaks the goal into mathematical tiers based on the target yield.
Yeah, let's start at the most conservative end of that. So, say you want to preserve your capital above all else. You want a low-risk environment, and you're aiming for a 3% real yield.
Which is very safe.
Super safe. The text points to things like high-grade sovereign debt, fixed deposits, or senior tranches of corporate bonds. But the catch, to get $20,000 a month at a 3% yield, your required capital base is approximately $8 million.
Which perfectly illustrates the cost of certainty.
Yeah.
You are essentially paying a massive premium in the form of needing to park $8 million just to sleep soundly at night. You are literally buying out the volatility risk.
Exactly. You're paying for peace of mind. But if 8 million is just totally out of reach for you, you have to move down the capital ladder and by default up the risk curve.
Right, you have to push for more yield.
So the moderate tier in the guide targets a 5% return. That points toward things like dividend-focused equities and real estate investment trusts. And suddenly, the required capital drops to roughly $4.8 million.
Which is still a huge number, but almost half of the first tier.
Yeah, a massive drop. And then if you push for an 8% return using a broader equity index strategy, you need about $3 million.
And then we hit the extreme edge.
Yeah, the Wild West. The text notes a 12% return target, pointing to highly speculative assets, things like crypto and early stage venture capital.
Which is incredibly aggressive.
Super aggressive. But at 12%, mathematically, you theoretically only need $2 million to hit the $20,000 a month goal.
The progression there is just a masterclass in the risk premium. It visually demonstrates that if you lack the raw capital, the market forces you to substitute cash with risk.
Right. It's a literal seesaw. Like, on one side, you have this massive pile of cash you need to anchor your side of the seesaw. And if you don't have that heavy pile of cash, you have to slide all the way to the edge of the board and just endure a wildly unstable ride.
That's a great way to visualize it.
But I have to push back on that final 12% tier. Like, I know the source includes it as a mathematical reality, but is aiming for a 12% yield in crypto or, seed stage startups actually a viable strategy for monthly income?
It's highly questionable.
Right. To me, relying on a crypto wallet to pay a $20,000 mortgage and buy your groceries feels fundamentally flawed. It feels like degenerate gambling disguised as a financial plan.
What's fascinating here is how the source explicitly separates the concept of average annualized return from sequence of returns risk.
Okay, break that down.
Well, you're absolutely right to call it out, because when people see a 12% historical average, they instinctively just divide it by 12 and assume, oh, I'll get a steady 1% monthly payout.
Like it's a paycheck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that entirely ignores standard deviation. Mm-hmm. High volatility assets don't yield steady distributions. Their returns are violently lumpy.
Yeah, it's not a smooth upward sloping line.
Far from it. You might see a 40% gain in year one,
right?
And then a 30% drawdown in year two.
Ouch.
Yeah. And if you are drawing down $20,000 a month to live on during that 30% drawdown, you are forcing the liquidation of your assets at severely depressed prices.
You're selling at the exact wrong time.
Precisely. You accelerate the depletion of your principal. The text makes it very clear. If you require this capital to provide a strict, non-negotiable monthly cash flow, high volatility assets are structurally incompatible with your goal. It doesn't matter what their theoretical yield is.
Right, because the mandate isn't just achieving the percentage.
No, it is engineering a steady distribution timeline.
Okay, so if an $8 million cash pile is unlikely for most people, and relying on a $2 million crypto portfolio is basically a recipe for a blown out account, we have to engineer something in the middle.
We have to find that sweet spot.
Right. We have to transition from abstract percentages to the mechanics of actual asset classes. How do you generate 5 to 8% without taking on catastrophic ruin risk?
And our source material outlines very specific vehicles for this.
Yeah, and I want to look at the friction involved in each of them. Let's start with physical real estate. The text specifically models rental yields in major Saudi Arabian cities.
Which is a very classic income play.
It is, but the capital inefficiency and the operational drag seem just enormous.
They are enormous. Direct real estate investment provides a really tangible inflation hedge and historically reliable cash flow. But the source emphasizes the illiquidity premium.
Meaning your money is trapped.
Exactly. You are trading liquidity for yield. And furthermore, physical property introduces severe operational friction.
Oh, like dealing with tenants?
Tenants, turnover, macroeconomic shifts in local zoning, and sudden capex requirements.
Right, like the roof caves in.
Or replacing a central HVAC system. That alone can wipe out an entire quarter of your expected $20,000 income.
Wow, yeah.
So you either absorb that friction directly, which basically turns your passive investment into a highly active second job.
Fixing toilets at 2 a.m. is not passive income.
Definitely not. Or you contract a property management firm, which then severely compresses your net yield because of their fees.
Which introduces the need for an alternative mechanism. If direct real estate traps your capital and demands your time, how do you capture the property yield without all that friction?
The text brings up REITs.
Right, real estate investment trusts. And I think a lot of people think of REITs just like buying a stock, but the underlying corporate structure is what makes them so unique for this specific income goal.
It's a very specific mechanism.
Being a landlord is like buying a cow, but a REIT is like just buying the milk at the store.
I love that analogy.
Because a REIT is like a massive financial syndicate. You aren't just buying shares in a company. You are buying a micro fraction of the underlying legal deed. And in exchange for special tax treatment, they are forced by corporate law to pass roughly 90% of their taxable income directly to you as the shareholder.
That is the exact mechanical advantage the source points out. The legal structure is designed explicitly for yield distribution.
So you don't have to fix the HVAC system.
No, and you instantly solve the illiquidity problem too. You can liquidate $1 million REIT position on the open market in milliseconds.
Wow, yeah.
Whereas selling a commercial building, that takes 6 months of due diligence. So with a REIT, you get the cash flow profile of commercial real estate, but with a frictionless execution of an equity.
But if we're moving into the equity markets for liquidity, we have to look at the next vehicle the text covers, which is dividend-focused stock portfolios.
This is a tricky one.
It is. Now, obviously, our listeners know how equities work, but building a portfolio specifically to spit out $20,000 a month introduces the classic dividend yield trap, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The source explicitly warns against simply screening the market for the highest dividend yield.
Because if a stock is paying 12%.
Right. If an equity is yielding 10 or 12%, it is rarely because the company is just wildly generous.
Yeah, that's a huge red flag.
It is almost always because the denominator of stock price has collapsed due to some underlying structural issue with the business.
Yeah.
But the board just simply hasn't cut the dividend payout yet.
It is a lagging indicator of distress.
Exactly. The market is pricing in a massive risk of an imminent dividend cut. To sustainably generate this level of income from equities, you cannot rely on distressed high yielders.
So what do you look for instead?
You have to focus on dividend growth. Companies with robust free cash flow, low payout ratios, and a long history of actually increasing their distributions over time.
Right, the aristocrats.
Yes. But again, as we discussed in the math section, achieving our target income purely through safe, growing dividends pushes your required capital base right back up to that $4 or $5 million range.
So if equities are volatile and direct real estate is illiquid, the text brings in the ultimate ballast fixed income. It specifically mentions bonds and Sharia-compliant sukuk,
which are crucial for portfolio stability.
Yeah, these sit at the very bottom of the risk curve, right next to our 3% yield tier. They don't offer much upside participation, but they offer absolute seniority in the capital structure.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the text is quietly illustrating the core principles of modern portfolio theory here, even without explicitly using the heavy academic jargon.
Okay, how so?
Because the secret to a durable $20,000 monthly draw isn't finding one magical asset class. It's exploiting the lack of correlation between them.
Oh, mixing them together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You pair the absolute structural certainty of a senior sukuk with the inflation-capturing growth of an equity index, and then you add the high-yield distribution of a REIT.
Because the markets are cyclical. They don't all move together.
Precisely. If macroeconomic tightening crushes your real estate valuations and compresses your REIT yields, well, your fixed income allocation continues to distribute its coupon payments exactly as legally contracted.
It doesn't care what the stock market's doing.
Not at all. The fixed income acts as the shock absorber, ensuring your actual monthly cash flow remains completely uninterrupted, even while the underlying net asset value of the rest of the portfolio is fluctuating.
It's all about engineering a system where one failure doesn't collapse the entire structure.
Exactly.
But, you know, even perfectly engineered systems fail if the operator introduces friction. And I want to pivot to the common mistakes section of the guide, because this is where we see the actual mechanics of capital destruction.
This is where people get in their own way.
Yeah. The text outlines exactly how investors sabotage their own income streams, starting with the psychological compulsion to chase yield,
which we just touched on with the dividend yield trap.
Right. But the broader principle here is that any mispricing in the market is almost instantly arbitraged away by algorithmic trading. So if you see a crazy high yield, there's a reason for it.
Which means if a retail investor is being offered a yield that sits significantly above the baseline risk-free rate, they're taking on hidden nonlinear risk.
Always.
There's no free lunch. None. The premium is compensation for a structural vulnerability in the asset. Could be credit risk, liquidity risk, counterparty risk. The text emphasizes that reaching for an extra 2% in yield is actually the primary catalyst for catastrophic principal loss.
You risk the whole pile of money just for a tiny bump in income.
Exactly.
The guide also hammers home the absolute necessity of maintaining a robust cash buffer. And this speaks directly to what we were just discussing about sequence of returns risk.
The buffer is critical.
Because if your REIT pays out quarterly and your bonds distribute semi-annually, the actual influx of cash into your checking account is lumpy. It's not perfectly spread out.
Right. You don't get exactly $20,000 on the first of every month.
So if you don't hold 12 to 18 months of living expenses in pure liquid cash, a sudden market drawdown combined with the delayed distribution will force you to liquidate your core assets at exactly the wrong time.
You literally cannibalize your own financial engine just to cover a short-term cash flow gap.
It is a totally self-inflicted wound.
It is. The cash buffer is what separates a distressed seller from a disciplined allocator.
But here's where it gets really interesting, because I want to vigorously challenge something the text highlights as a major pitfall.
Okay, we'll carry it.
It dedicates a significant warning to ignoring fees and taxes. Now, let's look at the actual reality of managing a $3 or $4 million portfolio.
Okay.
If I have hired a top-tier asset manager and they are successfully navigating this complex mix of equities, sukuk, and alternative assets to hit an 8% return, why should I agonize over a 1% assets under management fee?
Right.
Because, like, if inflation is 3% and the manager nets me 8%, my real return is still highly positive. Complaining about a tiny 1% fee feels like stepping over dollars to pick up pennies. Does it actually matter at that scale?
It matters more than almost any other variable you control. And honestly, your argument is exactly the psychological trap the source is trying to dismantle.
Wait, really? It's just 1%?
Let's look at the brutal mathematics of an AUM fee. It sounds negligible, 1%. But you are not paying 1% of your profits. You are paying 1% of your entire capital base every single year, regardless of whether the portfolio generates a positive return or a negative one.
Okay, walk me through the math on that. Like, what does that actually look like?
Sure. If you have a $4 million portfolio, a 1% fee is $40,000 in year one.
Okay.
But assuming your manager does their job and the portfolio grows to $8 million over a decade, you are now paying $80,000 a year just to keep the lights on.
Oh, wow.
It is a compounding negative drag. If you run a Monte Carlo simulation over a 30-year retirement horizon, a 1% annual fee doesn't just reduce your final wealth by 1%.
What does it do?
It can confiscate 25 to 30% of your terminal portfolio value.
30?
Yes. Because that 1% fee actively prevents that capital from remaining in the account and compounding upon itself over decades. It is a massive structural leak in the hull of your ship.
Wow. So I'm essentially financing the compound interest of the management firm using my own principal.
Exactly.
It's not a performance tax. It's a wealth confiscation mechanism.
It is. And the source pairs that with the ultimate unavoidable confiscation mechanism, inflation.
Ah, the silent killer.
Right. We don't need to define inflation for this audience, but we do need to address how it fundamentally alters the math of this $20,000 goal.
Because $20,000 today isn't $20,000 in 10 years.
Exactly. If you engineer a portfolio that successfully yields an exact static $20,000 a month and you pat yourself on the back, you have actually engineered a portfolio that guarantees your standard of living will decline every single year.
Because of the spread between nominal and real returns.
Yes. The text makes it clear that your true hurdle rate isn't hitting the specific dollar amount. It's maintaining purchasing power. If long-term inflation runs at 3.5%, your passive income stream must inherently grow by 3.5% annually just to tread water.
Just to buy the same groceries.
Exactly. A static $20,000 today will have the purchasing power of roughly $10,000 in two decades. If your underlying asset base isn't appreciating to continually bump up your nominal distributions, the entire strategy fails in slow motion.
That is a deeply sobering mechanical reality. I mean, when you aggregate all of this, balancing the exact weighting of REITs and equities, monitoring the correlation of fixed income, screening for yield traps, harvesting tax losses, and ruthlessly suppressing fees.
It's a lot.
It becomes intensely clear why generating passive income is actually a highly active endeavor. Managing a multi-million dollar portfolio across different asset classes is a full-time operational burden.
It really is.
And this is precisely why the guide transitions into the actual implementation layer, bringing up platforms like Osol Gamma as a way to reduce that administrative friction.
Because the cognitive load of rebalancing a complex portfolio manually will inevitably lead to behavioral errors. You'll make mistakes.
Right. You get emotional or you just get tired.
Exactly. The source points out that platforms like Osol Gamma are essentially automated allocation engines. They remove the execution friction.
Right. The value proposition highlighted in the text isn't just like a pretty user interface on an app. It's the curation and aggregation of these disparate assets.
Having it all in one place.
Instead of managing a separate brokerage for equities, a specialized desk for sovereign debt, and direct relationships with real estate syndicates, the platform unifies the macro view. But a highly specific feature the source highlights, and this is a massive operational bottleneck for a significant portion of the global market, is the automated Sharia compliance screening.
Which is a remarkably intensive due diligence process if you try to do it manually.
Exactly. For listeners who require Islamic finance compliance, you can't just buy a broad S&P 500 index fund and walk away.
No, you have to look under the hood.
You have to ensure the underlying companies don't derive significant income from impermissible industries like alcohol or gambling. But even beyond that, you have to constantly monitor their balance sheets for strict financial ratios.
For the debt ratios.
Right. Ensuring their debt-to-equity ratio or interest-bearing securities don't exceed a 33% threshold. Doing that manually across a portfolio of 50 equities is basically a full-time job in forensic accounting.
It creates a massive administrative drag.
Yeah.
And the text emphasizes that having a platform that algorithmically curates and continually audits these assets for compliance removes a layer of friction that traditionally forces investors into suboptimal, highly concentrated local investments.
Because it's just easier to buy local real estate than audit 50 global stocks.
Exactly. By solving the compliance bottleneck mechanically, the platform allows the investor to properly diversify across global asset classes, which directly addresses the exact risk concentration trap we discussed earlier.
It essentially acts as the chief operating officer for your capital, allowing you to act solely as the chief investment officer. So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive looking at a highly popularized goal, generating $20,000 a month in pure passive income. And what the source material has methodically demonstrated is that there are absolutely no shortcuts.
None at all.
It is an uncompromising equation requiring substantial upfront capital, a sophisticated grasp of sequence of returns risk, tactical asset allocation across non-correlated vehicles, and a ruthless defense against the compounding drain of fees.
You really have to treat it like a business.
You do. It requires operating with the precision of an institutional endowment rather than just our retail saver.
This raises an important question, though.
Oh, what's that?
We've spent this entire time optimizing the mathematical machinery required to hit this exact financial milestone. But if you actually succeed, if you engineer this perfectly balanced, frictionless portfolio that effortlessly drops $20,000 into your account every month, requiring zero active input from you, what happens to your psychological framework?
Oh, wow. That's a deep cut.
Well, think about it. We are biologically wired to derive meaning, status, and purpose from our economic utility and the friction of active problem solving.
From doing the work.
Yes. If you completely decouple your survival from your daily effort, does the achievement of total financial independence actually risk plunging you into an existential void?
That is heavy.
Are we so fixated on escaping the necessity of work that we forget to account for the psychological anchor that work provides?
That fundamentally changes how you view the finish line. It shifts the entire question from, can you afford to stop working, to can you afford the psychological cost of having no forced utility? Well, we want to thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep rigorously auditing the mechanics of your portfolio. Watch out for those compounding fees. And remember that optimizing your wealth is really only half the equation. Optimizing what you do with your time once you finally have it, that's the real challenge. We'll catch you on the next one.